Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we discuss why the Ukrainian armed forces are removing American Abrams tanks from the front lines. We deep dive into the capabilities of the ATACMS missiles, and we hear from a British volunteer who works in frontline villages across the east of Ukraine.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Friday, the 26th of April, 2 years and 63 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, Brussels correspondent Joe Barnes, reporter Lauren Shireff, and our guest is Minty Gao. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David. Hi, everybody. So Russian attacks against Ukraine over the last day has killed at least five, wounded around 30. Russia targeted a total of 10 Ukrainian oblasts. Casualties only reported, though, in Dnipropetrovsk, Kherson, Kharkiv and Donetsk oblasts. The Russian attack against the city of Dehashi in Kharkiv oblast yesterday injured four, including three children. This comes from the governor, Oleh Sinobov. That town, that city, is about 5 km northwest of Kharkiv, about 25 kilometres from the border with Russia at the closest point. The strike, which was thought to be a glide bomb there, hit a residential building in the centre of the city, only injuring, thankfully, a four-year-old boy, five-year-old girl, and a 16-year-old girl. Obvious military targets, I'm sure you'd agree. Elsewhere in Kherson, at least six people were injured after Russian bombing hit a shopping centre and a nursery. Alexander Prokudin, head of the regional military administration, put the note out on Telegram. And then two bombs struck an industrial facility in Sumy. No casualties reported there. Russian forces seem to be attempting to stabilise the small salient northwest of Avdiivka that they've gained in recent days. They are attempting to make further tactical gains, but seems to be culminating, obviously, the military term, not obvious, but sorry, I mentioned it a few times. It's a military expression meaning that you're no longer going forward. You've exhausted the force. You're not going backwards, but you're no longer going forwards. Geolocated footage yesterday shows Russian forces have pushed that salient northwest of Avdiivka, having committed what's thought to be roughly a reinforced division's worth of combat power to the area. So up to probably, I would imagine, 8,000-10,000 people there. The Russian forces appear to be trying to widen that penetration. It's a couple of k's across at the moment. They're trying to make that a bit wider. Following the significant advances into Oshretina, that's northwest of Avdiivka, these gains have been relatively quick, at roughly 5 kilometres over the last 2 weeks, but still spoken of by pretty much all the analysts I speak to and read as marginal. I'll come on to that in a moment. So this salient, it is vulnerable. Obviously, it's got exposed flanks. The town is of Oshretina. It sits on a junction between what's the Ukrainian defensive line that Russia's been attacking since they seized Avdiivka back in mid-Feb, and a further subsequent defensive line, Ukrainian line further west, which is thought to be much more heavily fortified. Russian forces are continuing offensive operations up and down the line, but this seems to be their sort of main effort for the moment. Only marginal gains, hundreds of metres, if that, made elsewhere. It's thought that they're just going to keep pushing with this salient, trying to widen it. They will go forward if possible, but I don't know if they've got the combat power to do so. I was speaking to a Western official yesterday, and their view was that Russia are just trying to bite and hold what they can. They'll seize territory, then just try to hang on to it. There doesn't seem to be any sort of grand operational, let alone strategic, plan behind this. They're just trying to grabbing whatever territory they can and trying to knit them all together. The Western official made the point that the mobilisation that Russia's gone through, tacit sort of mobilisation, has produced numbers, but they're only really able to replace the combat losses. They're not increasing the amount of troops markedly that Russia has at its disposal, and no breakthrough, this was the view of the official, no breakthrough is anticipated in a kind of operational sense. Chasiv Yar still under threat. This is about 50 km north of Donetsk, about 5 kilometres west of Bakhmut. Seen as more significant than Bakhmut because of what its hold. It's on high ground. It's on a sort of road junction heading off to Slovyansk. So it's seen as, for all this effort down in the salient we've been talking about, Chasiv Yar seems to be the thing that Russia's going for before the May the 9th Victory Day parade. That seems to be their objective. Just one other thing from the Western official I was speaking to. They said that Russian casualty figures, the average casualties, so killed, wounded, missing and captured, for March was 913 a day, the average across March. The Western officials said, I mean, partly as a response to Ukraine's lack of ammunition, that figure had dropped to a mere 823 a day throughout April so far. Staggering numbers, and that's likely to go back up again in July, August time when the Czech ammunition initiative really kicks in. That's the sort of date time we're expecting the hundreds of thousands of 155mm shells that the Czechia has been leading on make their way to the front line. Now elsewhere, and Joe's going to talk in a minute, I think, but US-donated Abrams tanks seem to be sidelined in Ukraine now amid fears that they are just too vulnerable to drones. This comes from US officials. One senior defence official speaking to Associated Press yesterday said the proliferation of drones on the battlefield means, quote, there isn't open ground that you can just drive across without fear of detection. We think 5 of the 31 tanks sent by the US in January last year have been lost to Russian attacks, including during the recent withdrawal from Avdiivka. The vice chairman of the joint US Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Chris Grady, said that for now, tanks have been moved off the front lines and the US are going to be working with Ukrainians to try and find a solution. I mean, no one has an answer to this yet. I would expect the same for the British Challenger, the German Leopards. No one's really got an answer for how to counter the FPV drones. So Ukraine obviously doesn't want to risk their tanks. Tank action is not a solo sport. You need all the combined arms of infantry and protected infantry vehicles and all the rest of it. So without all that in place, it does make sense for them to preserve their combat power and pull them back. Now, this month's Ukraine Defence Contact Group meeting has just started, just in the last couple of minutes. I was just watching the opening speech there by Lloyd Austin. The meeting was opened with a video from President Zelensky, or dialed in live, and I've just caught a bit of his speech. He said he was thanking the US for the recent aid bill that's got through, and Zelensky said, predatory regimes like Russia rapidly increase their appetite for aggression. I've dialed out of it to come here, but that's literally happening. It started just a minute or so before we came on air. It's expected during this meeting the US will provide more details about a $6 billion US dollar long-term military aid package to Ukraine. This funding comes under the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, separate from the military aid, but that's going to, we think, look at anti-drone stuff and lots of other bits and pieces, including possibly vehicles, Humvees, Bradleys and MRAPs. So MRAPs are mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles. Now, a couple more for me, David. China is providing moorage for a US-sanctioned Russian cargo ship implicated in the transfer of arms from North Korea to Russia. This is satellite images have been analysed by RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, a think tank based here in London. They said the Russian vessel Angara, which since August last year has moved thousands of containers believed to contain the North Korean munitions into Russian ports, has been anchored at a Chinese shipyard in eastern Zhejiang province since February. The ship's presence at the Chinese port underscores the challenges, RUSI say, facing the United States and everyone else, trying to choke off military and economic support for Russia. And with Ukraine under, obviously, this renewed Russian assault and running short of ammunition, US officials are highlighting increasingly stark warnings about what they say is China's help rebuilding Russia's military. That is likely to be top of the agenda for Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State. Today he started a three-day visit to Beijing. Kirk Campbell, State Department's second highest-ranked diplomat, said earlier this month that Washington would not sit by if Beijing increased its backing for Moscow. And a spokesman for the US State Department said it was aware of credible open-source reports that the Angara is currently moored in a Chinese port and had raised the issue with Chinese authorities. The official, I don't know if they're referring to the Russi report or it's just coincidental to it, but the official said, we call on all member states to fulfil their obligations under UN Security Council Resolution 2397. That restricts trade with North Korea and requires UN states to deregister any vessels involved in illicit activities. Russi, in their report, they said that before arriving in China on February the 9th, seemingly for repairs and maintenance, the Angara had been docked in January at North Korean and Russian ports, but had turned its AIS, the transponder, off. So you couldn't see, we couldn't see it electronically, but you could see it with satellite imagery. It again stopped transmitting shortly after arriving in China, they say. A couple more. Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko, he's claimed that several dozen Russian tactical nuclear weapons have been deployed in Belarus. Russia's TASS news agency said the move was part of an agreement jointly announced last year. We've covered that agreement before. Follows warnings made by Lukashenko that Belarus is facing grave threats internally and externally, of course they are, that have required it to change its security posture, meaning it must align with Russia further, not that he's just, you know, doing what he's told. Spain under pressure recently. Spain will send a small number of Patriot missiles to Ukraine. The El País newspaper reporting this morning, citing unnamed government sources. However, they're not going to send the launchers. Okay, I mean, missiles are good. Launchers would be better, but fine. The exact number of missiles being sent is not reported, but it's probably only going to be as small as Spain is thought to only have about 50 in total. Spain has three batteries of Patriots bought from Germany in 2004 and 2014. So that's kind of good. They've been under quite a lot of pressure recently, but yeah, the launchers would be quite helpful as well. And then just last for me, just in the last hour, I've seen a fairly bizarre video put out by Ukraine's intelligence, the main director of intelligence, the GUR. They are showing, or they purport to show, some of their operatives destroying a Russian Ka-32 multipurpose helicopter at Moscow's Ostavievo International Airport, which actually belongs to the MOD, Russian MOD, and is only 20 kilometres south of the city centre. It's inside the outer ring road of Moscow. It's not in the inner ring road, but it's very close to the centre of Moscow. And this video, you'll see it, you'll find it online. The intelligence director put out a video. It's at night, supposed to have been last night, although we've no way of knowing that for sure. You can see one person's doing something to a helicopter that then goes up in a ball of flame. So, I mean, if that is a GUR action so close to the centre of Moscow, well, it should be fairly concerning for Putin. And I'll take a little pause there, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom. We'll bring you some diplomatic and political updates shortly. But Joe, do you want to chime in just briefly for your thoughts on this news that the Abrams tanks have been pulled back from the front line? What's your take on that, Joe? Joe Barnes.
Hi, folks. Thanks for having me. I won't touch on it too much because I know Hamish is listening and hopefully he has helped me out today for the piece, which is going in tomorrow's paper, should be online very soon. So hopefully we could do a bigger, deeper dive Monday next week sometime. But I would say, don't see this as a big defeat or anything like that. I just think that is part of the changing nature of warfare in Ukraine. First of all, the front lines are very static. There isn't much space to do this combined arms maneuver, or there aren't actually that many large open spaces being contested. It's skirmishes at best over trenches, maybe the odd sort of village or something like that. So there's not a great deal of scope for them. And tanks have essentially been used rather than in their sort of proper capability where they're flying around the battlefield at sort of 45, 50 miles an hour, firing off very accurate shots from their 120 millimeter cannons. They're being used, as Hamish described them to me, as pillboxes, as maybe like long range snipers where they're sitting 2-3 kilometers away from the front line, scanning left to right, looking at targets to hit with their cannons. But that's not the best use of a tank. Then you have the fact that large Western main battle tanks, they prioritize armor from firepower over mobility. So that basically means they're really bloody heavy. They get bogged down and stuck in the Ukrainian mud at this time of year. So again, not a shock. But then I'd also look at what the sort of US officials are describing, the big proliferation of drones, that these drones, whether they be normal sort of spotter drones, DJI, those Chinese made commercial drones that scan the skies, then you've got these FPV drones, the first person view drones, the one-way attack drones, all of these are being used great effects. It doesn't leave a lot of space for a slow moving vehicle to get across a large open bit of land and then burst through breach lines. So it's more than likely, instead of it being the mission of defeat, tanks aren't working anymore, it is more than likely that the Ukrainians have gone, look, let's preserve our sort of premier tanks, these fighting machines. Let's bring them back. Let's get them repaired. Let's make sure they are modified. So probably we're going to see a lot of Pope cages, these metal cages above the tanks, which are used to defend from sort of aerial bombs being dropped on them, modified and waiting for when Ukraine actually wants to launch a proper counteroffensive. Because at the moment, the lines are very static. They're probably waiting until they have the full set of breaching equipment, artillery, and launch an actual counteroffensive to use their main tanks again, rather than wasting them on the front line. And I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. We'll come back to you later because I know you want to talk about TACMs. But let's move on to some diplomatic and political updates first. Dom mentioned there, of course, the visit of Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, to Beijing. Well, there's been some developments in that story. He said during this visit that Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine is dependent on support from China. A quote from Blinken, Russia would struggle to sustain its assault on Ukraine without China's support, he told reporters after lengthy talks with the Chinese President Xi Jinping and other officials. He said that during the meeting he had reiterated, quote, serious concern about China providing components powering Russia's war machine, and said Beijing had previously shown willingness to positively influence Moscow's actions, citing its stance on Russia's nuclear threat. These comments come after warning last week, as Dom said, that China is now the, quote, primary contributor to Russia's war in Ukraine. And he added that Beijing's supply of machine tools, semiconductors and other parts key to producing weapons is contributing to the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. On the Chinese side, they've repeatedly claimed not to have provided any weapons to either side in the conflict, and they have stated that they are not a producer or of any party involved in the Ukraine crisis. Moving to Russia's central bank has forecast that interest rates will stay high for longer in Russia this year as the war effort risks fueling inflation. I mean, we're reporting on this as a blow for Vladimir Putin, of course, who wants to maintain the illusion that nothing has changed and everything is going incredibly well. The Bank of Russia, some details, left interest rates unchanged at 16% for a third meeting in a row, but unexpectedly raised its average key policy rate forecast for the year. They increased their prediction from 13.5% to 15.5% to 15 to 16%, and also raised its inflation forecast and acknowledged for the first time that it may struggle to reach its 4% target this year. In a statement accompanying this decision, the central bank said, quote, tight monetary conditions will be maintained in the economy for a longer period than previously forecast. So we're seeing the impact of the war now, of course, into its third year, being acknowledged by the Bank of Russia. So that's quite interesting. We'll keep an eye on that story and hopefully have somebody from the business desk next week to tell us more about what's happening there. Staying in Russia, Kremlin officials have warned that NATO nuclear weapons would become a primary target for Russia if they were deployed to Poland. This comes as a quote from Sergei Ryabkov, the Russian deputy foreign minister, who said that moves in this direction will not provide greater security, that's for Poland or any other nations that host such weapons. Separately, Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said that any nuclear weapons deployed to Poland would be legitimate targets in the event of war with the alliance. Let's go to Poland then. An interesting story that's developing there. Poland has suggested it will help transfer Ukrainian men of fighting age back to their homeland. This is, of course, as Kyiv seeks to shore up its depleted armed forces. Poland's defense minister said he was ready to take whatever steps necessary to move tens of thousands of men of military fighting age back to Ukraine. He told Polish TV network Polsat, quote, we have suggested for a long time that we can help the Ukrainian side ensure that people subject to compulsory military service go to Ukraine. Asked if this would involve a request from Ukraine to transport men of fighting age, he added, quote, everything is possible. To add a dash of reality here, it's not immediately clear what steps Poland might take to transfer Ukrainian men, such as deportation or a bilateral agreement with Kyiv. And to remind ourselves, there are nearly a million Ukrainian refugees registered in Poland, of whom around 16% are males of fighting age. Dmytro Kuleba, the Ukrainian foreign minister, said in a recent post on social media, quote, staying abroad does not relieve a citizen of his or her duties to the homeland. Well, the reaction to that, on Wednesday, hundreds of Ukrainians were seen queuing outside a closed passport office in Warsaw, waiting to receive new passports. Remember that Ukraine is urgently working to recruit more troops and recently passed a mobilization law that lowers the fighting age and imposes tougher penalties on those who refuse to serve. Finally, in Ukraine, a corruption scandal has flared up in the government. Ukraine's agricultural minister, Mykola Solsky, was detained after being named a formal suspect in a multi-million-dollar corruption inquiry. This comes from prosecutors who talked about this on Friday. Mr. Solsky was accused of illegally seizing land worth more than $7 million when he was the head of a major farming company and a member of parliament. An anti-corruption court ordered him to be held in custody until June the 24th, and prosecutors have said that bail has been set at $1.9 million. Well, that's it for today's diplomatic updates. It sounds like every pilot's worst nightmare, the jamming of a plane's GPS while it's many thousands of feet above the Earth. Yet this sort of scenario is becoming more and more commonplace. New data shows that over 46,000 planes flying over the Baltic have logged GPS problems since last August. Our reporter, Lauren Sheriff, has been looking into how and why Russia is targeting planes. Here's our conversation. Russia's targeting our planes. Lauren, how do they do it?
So exactly how it's done is a mystery, essentially, to everyone, at least on the British side of things. It tends to be done by Russia and China. So when we say that Russia's interfering with our planes, there are two things that we know that Russia and some other countries do to mess with the signals, both on defense airlines, but also on commercial flights. And one of those is jamming, where signals are essentially interrupted and a pilot would see that their GPS isn't working. And there's also spoofing, where there's this appearance that there are objects in the way that maybe aren't, or other more sophisticated ways of messing with a plane's navigation system. And exactly how that's done isn't known by people in this country. Otherwise, we'd be able to stop it. But those are the two main things that happen to plane signals when we talk about Russian interference.
And where is this happening exactly? Where are airlines and pilots experiencing this jamming?
So exactly where it's happening is really hard to say, because when jamming or spoofing happens, there isn't an obvious difference between that and something that's gone wrong for a completely innocuous reason. It's just sort of an accidental fault with the GPS system. But according to Ops Group, which is a group that monitors the international airspace, these things became a lot more common around Ukraine in 2022 when the invasion happened. But in 2023, also became more common in the Middle East, but it's also seen in Pakistan and over China as well. So it's everywhere. But it's really hard to tell exactly what the different patterns are because of how similar it looks to a normal aircraft fault.
So what impact does this have on the pilots and on the planes?
To pilots, the impact is surprisingly little. I spoke to one pilot called Nick Eades. He was the world's longest-serving Boeing 747 pilot when he retired in 2022. And he said when this happens, it might be a bit annoying for a pilot and they have to put their coffee down and think about it for a second and use their brain and work out what to do, but it wouldn't even ruin their day. And maybe it's just that pilots have inbuilt nerves of steel, but it seems like it's so commonplace for pilots and they're so well trained to deal with it that they don't panic and freak out at midair.
You spoke to the former head of MI6, Richard Dearlove. What did he say about all of this?
Well, he wasn't surprised to hear about how often this is happening. What he said really is that this is an example of Russia's grey warfare on British people and on Britain in general and on the West. And he said that it's really a sign of the conflict with Russia that we are in, even though it's not open warfare, being so much more progressed and serious than most people in Britain realise. And he did say that this is a way of messing with people's way of life. And he drew parallels with interference with underwater internet cables that Russia has been linked to last year with three different outages. And he also said that it's a show of power on their part. They're not doing anything that would make a plane fall out of the sky, but they are saying, look, we're here and this is what we can do and you can try and stop us, but in 2 weeks we will have found a new way to jam plane signals. So he thought it was concerning, but not a life or death issue.
I guess what's quite interesting as well for listeners is that when we report on this, it always seems quite scary, right? Like Russia is interfering with the GPS systems of planes. But what you're saying is,
And what it sounds like the experts are telling you is it's low level, it's quite annoying, it's not life or death, but it does demonstrate intent and it demonstrates capability. Is that a fair reading of what you've seen?
Yeah, I think that's a fair reading. But when I spoke to Nikidis, the pilot, his reaction was, this whole thing's overblown. As a pilot, I really don't worry about it. When he started flying some 35 years ago, GPS wasn't even a thing on a plane. And for purpose of explanation, there are three different navigation systems that modern planes have. If you get on a flight tomorrow, then the flight that you're getting on has all three of these systems, and only one of them can be interfered with by Russia. So when I spoke to that pilot, he said, yes, it's annoying, but nobody's going to fall out of the sky and this whole thing. It's not hacking. It's just a thing that's always been the case. And all pilots are so well trained to deal with these issues that they really don't worry about it.
So the bottom line really for listeners and for travellers is it's annoying, it's frustrating, but it's not something we should be overly concerned with at the moment.
Yeah. If you're going on holiday this weekend, I wouldn't suggest that you should be concerned about anything that might happen due to Russian interference. But it doesn't look good for us, and it's not a good fact that this is a capability that Russia has and that we're not really sure what can be done to stop them interfering in that way. Certainly people like Richard Dearlove, who are thinking about the security of the country, see it as more of a significant issue.
Looking ahead then, did you get any sense from the pilots or from the experts you spoke to about how this might develop in the weeks and months and years ahead?
Well, it's certainly not going to go away, is the impression, unless there were to be some massive revolution in how Britain understands GPS technology. When I spoke to NATO, what they said is that GPS jamming will be a part of every conflict, and passengers might get caught up in that in no more serious of a way than they have been already, but that certainly this isn't going to go away. And what NATO's suggestion was is that this could potentially be something that is seen more broadly in conflicts in the future.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for your time. Joe Barnes, let's come back to you. You've written up a proper deep dive into the ATACM systems that Ukraine was so keen to get their hands on. Tell us what you looked at and what you found.
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot of fanfare when a new missile system, and the Ukrainians have been asking for the longer range attack. So with the introduction of the USA package, US officials started briefing, and this was then confirmed by Jake Sullivan, the US National Security Advisor, that the US had sent in ATACMS quietly ahead of the signature of the $61 billion aid package, and they'd actually already been used by Ukraine. So looking in depth at what this is going to add to Ukraine's forces and whether it's going to be a silver bullet or not. For almost a year, the British Storm Shadow, its French twin, the Scalp EG, so that air-launched cruise missile, had been the backbone of Ukraine's long-range attacks. They were incredible at the time. Since their arrival on the battlefield, May 2023, it unlocked a whole new set of Russian targets deep behind enemy lines. Warships in Crimea, bridges connecting Crimea to Kherson, ammunition dumps. Headquarters were a big one, especially under the Soviet Russian-style doctrine, where it's very top-heavy on handing out orders. The harder it is for commanders to give out orders if they don't have a headquarters to operate from. But like the introduction of any new high-tech, sophisticated weapon, the systems slowly become less effective. Ukrainian stockpiles dwindle. I did ask the Ukrainians, a few that I know, basically saying, who would know, whether the Storm Shadow scouts were running low before Britain announced it was sending more. And they wouldn't answer, so I think they are. And then Russia also adapts its tactics. It moves things out of range. It builds defences around cruise missiles that travel the same speed as a fast-moving jet, about 600 miles an hour. So with the introduction of ATACMS, the Army Tactical Missile System gives Ukraine a whole new weapon. Instead of an air-launched cruise missile, it's a ground-launched ballistic missile, travel, I think, about 2,300 miles an hour. That's three times the speed of sound, which makes it bloody difficult for air defence to intercept. So I spoke to Justin Crump, friend of the Telegraph. He is the chief executive of a strategic intelligence company. Sibling, again, he's like Hamish. He's a former British tanker. He's served in the military for God knows how many years. And he told me, with a ballistic missile, you might see it coming, but you've got about 3 minutes to do anything about it. And then in those 3 minutes, it's only going to be in your engagement area for about 30 seconds. So you've got to fire something off very quickly, not an easy target. So he was saying that you'll know once it's been fired, it might take a while to exactly work out the missile's trajectory and where it's going to impact. So all you can do is warn everyone to duck for cover. So that's going to put significant strain on Russia's air defense. So essentially, you've got about 600 miles of front line that they have to defend. But now they're going to have to slowly think about defending deeper as well. So it's going to really thin Russian air defenses, or at least force them to think about defending more land. So Justin was speculating, thinking, theorizing that it would take only about 10 attackums for Ukraine's forces to uncover the entire front line and some 155 miles behind it. We don't know how many attackums Washington has given to Ukraine, but Jake Sullivan says it's a significant number. Justin, the expert, is saying there's nowhere that's safe. It's not just an attack that you have to be able to intercept 60 miles of the front line right in front of Russian tanks, broadly. They also have to look at what is being behind them. So they've just got a much greater area. But the benefit of Attackum over Storm Shadow, travels at 600 miles an hour. There are early signs of launching. The Russians, when an Su-27 fighter jet, which carries the Storm Shadow, goes up in the air, they'll know. Whereas actually a M270 MLRS, the tracked MLRS system that was donated by Britain to Germany, and the HIMARS donated by the US, they're on the ground, so they're harder to spot, even though the Russians are getting better at spotting them. Is it a silver bullet? Probably not. It's not going to win the war on its own. But it is part of a shaping of the battlefield, and it's an important element that Justin Crump refers to. It will keep adding to the gnashing teeth we've been hearing from Moscow. Then we've got to look at how do the Ukrainians use these attackums that they have. Single missiles, yes, they will get through. But let's look at the recent Iranian attack on Israel. Russia does it as well. The Ukrainians have done it. And they look at firing long-range weapons en masse. So of the 300 munitions that Iran fired at towards Israel, it was only the ballistic missiles that got through. So if you imagine that Ukraine picks several air bases in occupied Crimea that it's going to launch a large-scale raid against, it fires off drones to start distracting air defense, to start showing where those air defense units are. Then you could start firing off the shorter range attackums, which have those bombable bearing the cluster munitions. Then you fire in your storm shadows. Then you fire in your actual long range ballistic normal attackums. And suddenly it's quite a successful raid. And who knows what happened. So this is what Justin was saying. He said, look, it's mass and range, really. It's all about using these tools together to confuse and overwhelm the enemy's defenses. What Ukraine really wants to do is have a strategic effect by making sure Russia doesn't have any supplies or can't offload their equipment, because things like railway offloading equipment is destroyed, killing Russians in assembly and rest areas, destroying Russian headquarters, as I mentioned earlier, so it can't carry on issuing orders down and therefore stalling offensive momentum. So I was also then speaking to Dr. Sidkarf Kushal, who is a fellow at the Rusi think tank in London. And he was saying, actually, if you suddenly start focusing and putting Russia's VKS Air Force under pressure, it will stop being able to drop glide bombs on targets so freely. Look back at Avdiivka. Probably the defining, the real changing moment was when Ukraine started lacking short-range air defense. It enabled these glide bombs to be dropped on the city, forcing the Ukrainians to withdraw. So it's a really defining element of the Russian offensive, Russian war tactics at the moment, these glide bombs. But as soon as you start pushing those planes back, because they are not at airfields as close to the front line, because Russia is going to have to adapt, it's going to have to move things further to the rear, meaning they're less ready for frontline operations, that's going to have an effect, maybe give Ukraine some momentum back. So this is what Dr. Kushal had to say. He said, additionally, the US seems to prefer that US supplied weapons be used on Ukrainian soil, but their very presence also forced the Russians to reconsider the safety of aircraft in other bases. If the VKS has to operate from air bases further back, it limits the Russian Air Force's operational tempo and thus its overall effect on the ground. But what I will say is we don't know. So the US have always had, and they've been one of these countries that have most fretted about the fears over escalation. So they've always had red lines on their equipment. You can't use them to attack Russian territory, but Joe Biden did mention that they would be able to be used on Ukrainian sovereign territory, and we know that an ATACMS hit an airbase in Crimea. So that is something that we believe now the US has accepted. They're going to say Crimea is Ukraine, go for it, attack those. They are being used. But what stops the Russians thinking or even planning for the contingency that these ATACMS could be launched at mainland Russia? So again, that's further spreading, further thinning the air defense. So it's just really adding to the headache that the Russians are going to be suffering with the introduction of ATACMS. And I'd also speculate, let's look back at some of the past decisions. Germany has liked to move in lockstep with the US. It only released Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine once the US agreed to Abrams tanks being sent. So maybe, and pure speculation, I've not actually asked the Germans about this yet if they've changed position, but maybe this will act as an enabler to get the Taurus missile also released. That's a massive prize for the Ukrainians. If they can disable that bridge, that will strike fear into Russia and might make them consider how they do things overall. But I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Joe. A proper deep dive there.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Before we go to our final thoughts then today, a final interview from us. Earlier this week, I caught up with British volunteer Minty Gao, who's been travelling and working across eastern Ukraine with Hopeful, a British charity that delivers warm food to communities close to the front line. I was keen to hear about her experiences in villages so close to the front. What were the interactions with the locals like, and what were their stories? Here's our conversation.
Well, Minty, thank you so much for your time. Could you start just by introducing yourself?
Yeah, of course. So I am Minty Gao. I'm a journalist as well, but I'm actually out here as a volunteer working with the charity Hopeful, which was formerly known as Siobhan's Trust. It's a Scottish charity. And what we do is we bring pizzas around to liberated villages, IDP centres, and people who are really in need out here in the east of Ukraine.
Could you tell us a bit more about what you see when you go into these villages? Take us into your mind's eye when you go into a newly liberated village or a village very close to the front lines. What do you see?
So it's really different every village we go to, and no village is the same, but there's one village in particular that I think would most indicate and give a better picture about what it's like, which is actually in Mykolaiv, and we went there a week ago. And this village was actually located on the front line for 8 months. And it's got a sugar factory in the middle of the village. And that's basically the purpose of the entire village. Most people are there because they work in the factory. But because of the infrastructure there, it also meant that that was a line and there was crossfire, which the factory and all the locals were caught up in. And actually, I think one of the longer term volunteers described it the best. She's been here for 2 years and she said that she thought it was one of the most depressing places she'd ever been, because the entire village was just completely destroyed. The buildings had bullet holes in them if they were still properly standing. Windows were missing from everywhere. And the location we set up our trucks, it was this massive contradiction, because we had our pizza fans, everyone smiling, laughing, wearing our kilts, doing face paint, children having fun. But it was all behind this building that had no windows, had half of its walls with cracks down the middle of it. And the people were just extraordinary. Sadly, there had actually been an attack in the city centre of Mykolaiv around there the day before. And so it was a national day of mourning. So we weren't allowed, we didn't have any music on. It was a lot more held back. But the children were so overjoyed to be distracted, which I think is the main thing we see around here, which is so interesting. And not just the children, it's the babushkas, it's the grandmothers, it's the grandfathers, it's the parents, people who've been through the most horrendous things that I think people can just imagine from what they've read in the papers and what they've listened to. And yeah, they were there wanting to come and draw on us and face paint us. A little girl came up to me and translated. She said, "I've been thinking about it since I saw you. I really want to give you a tattoo and I know what it is. Can I do it?" And she was 5. And I have to be honest, I have absolutely no idea what it was she drew on me. But it was amazing. And she was so proud of herself. And it was weird to think that for 8 months of her life, she's lived in the most awful conditions yet could be that happy to see other people. And actually something that I was talking about earlier with some of the other volunteers is in these few hours that we're there, even though the places are so depressing and crumpled and just falling apart, really, the people for those few hours are just so happy. And then suddenly every 50 faces or so, you see someone who can't quite get the ghosts to go to the back of their head. Those ghosts can't quite be separated. And it's when they hug you and speak at you in Ukrainian, so full of thanks, but you can see the tears kind of welling up in their eyes. And you can tell they're talking about what's happened, but you don't really know necessarily what they're saying. And it's just takes you back a bit, and you kind of realize that they may be happy for a couple hours, but they have all been through the most incredible things.
What do you make of the people who are still there? I mean, obviously so many people have left, certainly frontline villages and towns. Who's left in these places? Does it still feel like a sort of representatives from every bit of society, or is it really sort of mainly older people or younger people? What do you see?
It is predominantly older people. That definitely makes up most places we go. Sometimes there'll be no children when we go. Sometimes there'll be a surprisingly large amount of children. It's predominantly women, which I guess isn't that surprising, as most men, especially over here, are out fighting. Interestingly, though, I was speaking to Anna, who's a woman who decided to stay out here. She is in her 60s. She stayed out to actually help look after older people. And she was saying what's changed over the 2 years is that at the beginning, she lived in Mykolaiv, there were no children. And she said, you'd go into a shop and it would be weird because there'll be no children screaming. And it would just be this kind of silence, this deafening silence. But now people seem to have returned and there are more children. And then there are also the children who have stayed, who I think are the most incredible people ever, because sometimes they turn around and start telling you stories of what they've seen and act as if it's normality, which is crazy to think about from the position we all come from in the UK. But it's definitely older people predominantly. But if there are children, they kind of rush to us at these sites. So that's quite amazing to see, really.
Could you paint us a little bit of a picture then of what happens when you first arrive? What are you bringing them? How do you set up? Do you get people who are a little bit bemused by what's happening? How do you sort of explain to them what you're doing?
So we have fixes in each location or around certain parts of the east. So our local one here is Nina, and Nina looks at Zaporizhia. She looks at all the way over to Kharkiv, Dnipro. And she gets in touch with these peoples, and there seems to be representatives of each place we go, because quite often you'll see a babusa, an older lady who very much takes charge, gets everyone in the queue, tells everyone what's going on, tells everyone, no, you can only have one pizza, you can't have five, and speaks to them. So often we get there and everyone's waiting for us, which is crazy. It's the biggest welcome I've ever had in my life, but everyone's so excited to see you. And then set up, everyone usually sits back, especially in the east. We do have a team in the west, and when I was out there, I guess the desperation's a lot less, I would say, and people rush forward and want to eat before you've even turned on the ovens, whereas over in the east people are way more held back. They kind of stay back politely and kind of more reserved. So we arrive in, get our vans in a formation, start putting up. We have bins to provide a line so that everyone knows where to go. We get the pizza ovens going, the pizza shuffle, we get them all out the freezer, open the pizzas. And we also have a sponsorship deal with Coca-Cola at the moment, where they provide us of Coke, so we can give everyone a cup of Coke while they wait and while they have their pizza, which is quite fun, especially the little kids. But I do feel sorry for their parents at the end of the day. A lot of caffeine for them. So by the time we've set up, you kind of see people start to come forward slowly as soon as that first cup of Coke is poured. But the first pizza comes out and we kind of beckon them forward. And at that point, it's trying to keep them away. That's the difficulty. As soon as they realize how open it is and we have the music blaring, everyone kind of rushes forward because they see what the idea is about. But setup only usually takes about 15, 20 minutes. Everyone's got quite good at it now, which is pretty cool. And they've got good structures going on. And the people seem to just sit back and watch what happens, let you do your thing.
How many of you are out there, and what kind of precautions do you have to take? I mean, it must be quite dangerous being in some of these places.
So there are 11 of us at the moment, which is kind of average. At the moment, the max we'll have is 14. But actually, I was speaking to one of the men who lead the operation out here in the east. And because of the bigger discussions about a Russian offensive starting any day now, they are going to limit that to 9 people. That's like one of those safety precautions they're going to introduce to really make sure it's easy to get out when you can, if necessary, and when you can. We always have enough so that we can have a radio in each van. That's one of our main things we always have, so that each van can always be in contact. And we always go in convoy if someone gets separated, immediately make plans to resolve that. And we all stay in the same place. So we did have a bit of an incident where, because we're in Zaporizhia, and sadly the hotel that we always stay in was next to a factory which got blown up, which was in the news a while ago. And that happened about a week and a half ago. And so that hotel is gone. So we've had to move location. And a few of us stayed in the apartment that we have here. But sadly, I'm not sure if your listeners know of the attack on an industrial site here in Zaporizhia, I think 3 days ago now. But that was very close to where we were staying. In fact, I was one of the girls out here. She woke up to the first one thinking it was thunder in her dreams and went, "Oh, it's nothing," fell back asleep because they were ballistic missiles. So there was no siren. And it was so close to us. And I slept through that first one. And the second one came and hit target. And you could feel the whole building completely shake. It was quite uncomfortably close, that one. And sadly, the apartments, not all apartments have bunkers out here. And in fact, we did a Google search and the closest one was the hotel, which was a 10-minute walk away. So for all the people out here, it's very easy to think that they can just go and sit in a bunker when things get scary, but it's really not that simple for a lot of people. And so we went down and stayed at the bottom of the footwell. But now we've moved and decided it's worthwhile being all together. So we're now in the hotel. So it's kind of always adapting based on what happens and what's the safest solution for everyone, and making sure everybody knows where the bunkers are. In our group chats, everyone's room numbers listed just in case someone doesn't come down. And yeah, always having a quick exit plan.
What are the sort of maybe the myths or the things that are different about doing what you do, volunteering in Ukraine, than before you went that surprised you about the place?
One is that every time an air alert goes off, everybody runs to their bunkers. One of the volunteers worded this so perfectly, which is that the reality is an air alert goes off, you look around you, and if a mother is still pushing her pram, realistically, you're going to stay out as well. A lot of these alerts go off across the country every time something leaves Russian airspace. And so because of that, it's not always certain whether it's local. And so it kind of showed the importance of Telegram to me and the apps that you use to check where they're landing. So that's definitely the main one. You become quite attuned to the air alerts going off. And the second one, I know that everybody talks about the strength and the amazing ability of the people here to continue fighting. But oh my God, it's even more than I thought was possible. It's crazy. That night where we had that huge attack, and thankfully nobody was hurt in it, but it was definitely a shaky night. That was also the day of that big Dnipro attack. And so everyone's spirits within our group were quite disheartened. We were all feeling a bit low. And me and another volunteer decided to go, and with the help of our fixer, we found some amazing ladies who knit military nets, which happened across the country. We were speaking to them and we went and helped them for the day. And it was amazing. They were completely unfazed. So these women are there Monday through to Sunday, every day of the week. They do not have a day off, no matter what happens. They're 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. The youngest woman there was 26 years old. She had lost her job and decided not to get a new one and actually just do this full time instead. And their resilience is absolutely incomparable to anything else. And you may think that people who come out here, who volunteer, are amazing, but actually it's the people on the front line who are absolutely making all the difference. These home fronts are so essential. And they know how important the netting is, for example, so they just won't stop doing it. And that resilience, I just think, is completely amazing and something that I really do think we undermine. But on that note, they did turn around and ask us, which really, this really resonated with me. We were the first ever international volunteers they had had. And the main thing they wanted to know was if people in the UK actually cared about the war. Not if they supported Ukraine, they just wanted to know if they cared and who they were rooting for.
Aminty, what are your next movements? How long are you staying out?
So sadly, I'm only out here for a week left now. I've been out for 2 weeks. We were planning on going up to Kharkiv. In fact, we were meant to be going there today or tomorrow. But in light of what I just said, it's deeming a bit too dangerous at the moment. So we're not going to be. We're going to be travelling up towards Dnipro, moving around this area a bit more, hopefully spreading our wings a bit further. But we're playing it by ear. Don't know where we're going to go, and keep on kind of going with how everything is here and adjusting to make sure that everyone's safe.
And just finally, did you say earlier that you're wearing kilts? What's that about?
Yeah, this is amazing. I'll send you a photo, actually, if your listeners want to see it. But we have got kilts made. The Scottish, I can't remember, it's the Highland Kilt Makers, but these professional kilts have been made. That's Ukrainian tartan. You can actually find them in some museums now. And it is proper Scottish kilts, but in the Ukrainian colours. As I said earlier, the charity is a Scottish charity set up by a family over there, and all of our trustees, not all of them, but a lot of them are based out there. And so we wear these kilts to kind of fuse the two of them. Also, it is hilarious the amount of people that try and lift up one of our Scottish founders' kilts to see if he's a real Scotsman, which he is, I will add. So the poor guy has had a little couple close calls with some babooses. But yeah, so we've got these kilts out that we wear to kind of make it a bit more fun and prove where we're from. And also actually, so that from immediately, first of all, it's a conversation starter, but on top of that, it actually shows that someone from another country cares and is there.
Well, Minty, thank you so much for your time. Do stay safe when you're out there. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you so much, David, and good luck.
Thank you so much, Minty, for your time. Now let's go back to Dom and Joe for their final thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, David. So chatting with this Western official yesterday, and he said that the pendulum is swinging back in Ukraine's favour. Now, they weren't overdoing it, they weren't overblowing it, but I thought that was quite telling and quite strong. I thought that was maybe a little bit too rose-tinted spectacles because, I mean, they are really under the cosh at the moment, Ukraine. The Russian army is not doing anything. It's moving because it's got mass and a very low moral bar, as in it just doesn't care how many people it kills to get a few extra metres of territory. There's no tactical genius to what they're doing. They're moving forward more because of the lack of capability on the Ukrainian side rather than an amazing capability from Russia's side. So this army is tired. Yeah, in a few places it's innovating and trying to change, but it's not really doing anything particularly special at all. The weather's helped it a bit. The ground is drier. It allows more manoeuvre, but it's really not doing an awful lot. So with all that to one side, I mean, there are a few things tipping in Ukraine's favour at the moment. Obviously, the US aid bill, with the first munitions from that expected in the next, well, very small number of days. I think over by the weekend, we were expecting the first 155mm artillery rounds because they're coming from European bases, not mainland US. The attacker, as Joe's just been mentioning, Russia has failed to destroy Ukraine's energy grid. Kharkiv is under great pressure and there are still strikes on the energy infrastructure. But, you know, that hasn't worked for the second winter running. The weather's getting warmer anyway. The Black Sea Fleet is, what's left of it, is not doing anything. It's mostly in base in the Novorossiysk, you know, in Russia. Ukraine's getting the grain out. So there are areas. I mean, the battlefield, yes, it's moving very incrementally, tactically. Nothing operational happening really in Russia's favour. So I was a little bit surprised at the Western officials' sort of upbeat tone. But maybe when you look around, there are, obviously the war is much wider than just what's happening on the battlefield. So there are areas where you can see that maybe things might be looking slightly better over the summer. Now, I would expect Russia to have calculated that as well. And obviously they saw what happened in the US last week. They will be trying to push as hard as they can before all those munitions turn up. So I would expect it to get much more violent in the next few weeks. I would expect more ground to be taken by Russia. No amazing breakthroughs, but I would expect there more to be happening there. But yeah, I just leave that thought with you. I wonder what your views are, folks, on whether or not you think the pendulum, as this Western official said, the pendulum is swinging back towards Ukraine.
Thank you very much, Dom. Joe Barnes, would you like the very final words?
Yeah, I think maybe pendulum swinging very slowly is probably a bit optimistic, but the Ukrainians don't sort of lack any resolve, any grit, any determination, and all the weapons that are hopefully coming in their direction. Some interesting words from Jens Stoltenberg this morning. He was accepting an award in Germany yesterday, and he went on to basically say, look, European countries must now step up assistance to Ukraine because they haven't delivered the ammunition that they promised to Kyiv. And he said, in Europe, the delivery of ammunition is far below the levels we said we would provide. In recent months, NATO allies have not provided the support we have promised. He described Ukraine as outgunned because of the shortfalls of these supplies from both the US and Europe. He's been a staunch critic of the US for lagging and stalling on its aid package. But let's hope that actually makes a difference. That's very important. But now I'll touch on Emmanuel Macron, the French president, yesterday gave this incredible, sprawling 2-hour speech, which touched on almost everything. But he did make some very important points about European security. So Macron described the world as being at a turning point, and he said that Europe can no longer depend on America for its security. So think of NATO, Article 5 guarantee, basically a sniper Donald Trump, who has undermined that Article 5 by saying that Russia could do whatever the hell it wants to NATO members that aren't paying that 2% or hitting that 2% target of GDP spending. But he then also went on to say, look, we've been too, Macron this is, too reliant on Russia for energy, where Europe is slowly trying to pull itself off of Russian fossil fuels post-war, but it's still buying liquefied natural gas. So there is still gas being pumped into Europe as well. There is still countries using coal and other sort of fossil fuels from Russia. And then he went on to say China for its industrial production. So he's basically saying, look, Europe has to become strategically autonomous. They're saying, but it's nothing new. Basically be able to support itself independently of American security guarantees, Chinese technology and Russian fuel. And he said, we are too slow and not ambitious enough, saying that basically through power, prosperity and humanism, Europe could set a distinctive model for the world by basically investing massively in its own defense industry, in green tech and other fields like artificial intelligence. He basically said Europe should never be a vassal of the United States. This is a Macron who basically described NATO as brain dead in an Economist interview in 2019, racking my brains back, and basically someone who, through the prism of his own thoughts, believes that Europe should be able to stand on its 2 feet independent of the US. I don't think that is a view that's becoming more and more recognised, but I think actually the really mainstream view in Brussels, where I am, especially amongst the NATO allies, is yes, Europe has to do more to support its own security, its own self. That's more on defence spending, has to become less reliant on the US, but we're part of a big alliance and that's not going to be broken.
That's a fantastic final thought, and thank you very much for listening to 2 hours of Emmanuel Macron speaking French. Thank you, Dom. Thank you, Joe. Thank you all for listening, and have a very good afternoon.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Rachel Porter, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
a section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com